Hey, everybody. So does this sound plausible? Zombies come flying out of the ocean via tidal wave onto land and attack and kill everybody? Well, it is, because a movie exists about it. It's called Zombie Tidal Wave. It's from the director Anthony Ferrante, who is the creator and director of the Sharknado movies. And those movies are totally factually based. There's a tornado, and it sweeps up sharks from the ocean and throws them on land and attacks people. It could happen. It could happen. So Anthony Ferrante is a really interesting guy. Created these movies out of nothing. They became this franchise of six movies. A really cool conversation with him about how he came up with the idea, how the idea came about, how they shoot these movies on a very low budget, why that these filmmakers are passionate about the movies. And if you haven't seen them, you got to see them, because they're fun. They're out there, but in a good way. So I'm really psyched to have him on. This is somebody that is sort of an outside the box kind of thinker, and did something that took everybody by surprise and became a cultural phenomenon. So glad to have him on the show. Hope you enjoy him. And as always, follow me on Facebook, Twitter at Paul Mercurio. Go to iTunes, leave a nice comment about the podcast. Always helps. Tell your friends about it, and enjoy the Sharknado, man. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. My guest this week has a new movie out, and I'm a big fan of the movies that he's been doing. I was on board from the very first one of his Sharknado movies. He has a new movie out, Zombie Tidal Waves. The creative director of the Sharknado movie franchise is Anthony Ferrante, who is Italian but not from New York. welcome, man. Nice to have you on the show.
No, thank you so much. It's been an honor. That's going to be fun.
Zombie Tidal Wave is on Sci-Fi as we speak, and the movie title, I think, kind of speaks for itself. Obviously, there's zombies that sort of emerge from the ground under the water, under the ocean, and then are swept onto the land to wreak havoc. Is that a fair?
I think you got the wrong synopsis. It's a turn of the century love story. I think you're mistaken.
I got to get better with my research. Sharknado. I remember watching that and then literally going around my neighborhood to people saying, "You got to see this. It's really great." And you've talked about it. You didn't want to make these to be campy. You didn't want to make it so bad that it's good, as you say, and you haven't. Why do you think, is it just pure escapism for people? Like, why do you think that the Sharknado movies just sort of caught on the way they did?
Well, I mean, everybody asks that, and it's, we've thought about the different possible reasons for it. And I think that it's one of these weird things where when we went into it, it wasn't let's just go make a ridiculous movie and, I don't care. I'm just making this shark movie and I'm moving on to the next thing. Now it's going to be, talking teapots. It wasn't anything like that. We were genuinely invested in the title, and we loved the title and thought it was fun. And so that sort of sense of fun came across in the film. The movies, despite being about sharks and a tornado, there's a story. I mean, it's about family, and through the course of the six movies, you kind of became invested with, Ian Ziering and Tara Reid and what they were doing. I also think it was free. It was on the summer. It was a summer where the theatrical films were really dark and depressing, and here was something for free on a network that looked like a big studio movie, but didn't look like it had the budget, but it seemed fun. And I think that audiences also want to find and discover something, and they don't want something shut down their throat, with all this marketing. And I think Sharknado, our fans, we owe the success to them. They made us blow up on Twitter. They discovered us without any marketing. It was all grassroots stuff that was done. And also, I think the other factor is that it was a movie that had stars that weren't, oversaturated in these type of movies. It wasn't Eric Estrada or, whoever. It was Ian Ziering and Tara Reid and John Hurt. I mean, it was a pretty awesome cast.
Yeah.
So I think
yeah.
that elevated it.
Yeah.
And the title, when you hear the title, it makes you smile. And I think that at the end of the day, what was the big success is that, we were having fun, and you could see it on screen. And even if there was, rough edges with it, it still was a, you know, a ride, and you could tell that we were having fun. And I think that translated.
Yeah, that all comes through. And I think you're right about the fan. You mentioned sort of these, and they're great, you know, the Marvel movies, Avenger, this and that. And there's just so many now that they're all becoming a blur for me on some level. And you can't walk around anymore without seeing some promotion for some version of that franchise. This was something where you go, whoa, what is it? First of all, the title itself just brings you to it. If you don't watch it for that, then there's something wrong with you, right? And I did exactly what you said. I watched and I thought, Jesus, this is like funny and bizarre and like dark. It had all of these things going on. And I started to tell people about it and they watched and they felt the same way. And I haven't done that with a lot of movies. I really thought and that's not an easy thing to do, you know? Because you've said, and I think this is your quote, there's a sincerity in its ridiculousness. What does that mean exactly? Like, because I thought that was a really interesting way of putting it.
Well, you know, a studio movie has, $200 million and, you know, 100 days to shoot it. We have less than $1 million in 18 days. And, you know, when we go into it, we're trying to reach for that. But, you know, sometimes, you know, you're going to have those rough edges. And, you know, we care about the movie just as much as they care about their Marvel movies, you know, nice. And I think that's the sincerity part. You know, we're not looking at this as just like, oh, it's just another gig, or, you know, we just want to make a crappy film. That's never the intention. I mean, the amount of time and effort and the black hole that I go into make these movies, and when you're away from your family for 6 months, you know, you don't want to go spend 6 months working on something that you absolutely hate.
Right.
You know, you got to have a little bit of love for it.
Right.
And, you know, I genuinely love the characters of these films. You know, this movie wasn't all, another thing too about Sharknado, it wasn't based on an existing IP. It was a completely original idea that was successful. It wasn't based on a book. It wasn't based on anything. And so what that allowed us to do was to actually create our own mythology. And I have a sort of a record of being a director starting from the first movie all the way to the sixth movie, doing consecutive movies. No other filmmaker has done six movies in a row from the beginning. And so by being there and actually having the same cast, I was able to kind of tell a complete story over six films, even though it was never intended that way. So I was always the filter to make sure that, no, we won't do that, but we can do this. And then each film, we progressively got more and more ridiculous. But it still was grounded in that, remember, Finn did this in number one, so we have to do this. I think the thrill for me was doing the last Sharknado, able to end it on our own terms and not like suddenly have to have, you know, somebody else playing, you know, our lead characters because, you know, we couldn't get them back. And to be able to actually go back, since the time travel movie, to go back into the first movie. And there are things that people would always ask, what is this Mexican drug boat have to do with, or shark fin boat at the beginning of one have to do with anything. And then to actually kind of go, okay, well, it has to do with this. So we were able to, you know, something that was never intended to be explained, we got to kind of explain it a little bit. And, that was really fun.
Yeah. And when you're making each installment, is it becoming harder and harder to make, because generally with success in Hollywood, the more something becomes successful, the more people want to put their fingerprints on it and start to give them more and more notes and make it more complicated. Did you experience that, or were you pretty much like the first one, which I assume you were, left alone to your own designs?
Well, you know, I mean, look, like, you know, there's definitely the network had ideas for these movies, and you know, you have sort of a brain trust at, you know, the production company that we're at. But I mean, if you look at the movies, they're definitely out there. I mean, there would be things that we would come up with that the network would reject, and then in the next movie we would do it. So,
oh, really?
That's the thing of like, we would always have ideas, and again, because it's our franchise and we could do whatever we want. You know, anything was, you were able to throw out there. But I remember the movie. And Cassie Sturbo, who plays Nova, wasn't coming back for that film. And we had a new character named Gemini, and it was played by Mafia Lucia, who I love to death. She's really cool in the film, and I've done some other projects with her. And so I didn't want to have it be one of the things where, you know, like you're watching a movie and suddenly a different person is in there and it's supposed to serve that purpose. And, you know, the audience goes, well, that's not Nova or whatever. And so I said, well, I think that she's part of a Sharknado sisterhood that Nova created. And the network was like, no, no Sharknado sisterhood. But I basically said, well, you guys may say that we're not doing Sharknado sisterhood, but I'm saying that it exists in our world. And I made it, and I basically put enough in there that that was part of it, even though we never said it out loud. And then in a fifth movie, we were able to do the Sharknado sisterhood because Nova came back and I was able to pay off that Gemini was part of the sisterhood. So it's like kind of one of those little seeds that you inserted. And then in the fifth movie, I wanted to do a army of Tara Reid clones. And I was like, right. No, you can't do that. But I'm going, no, but the army of Tara Reid clones can stop Sharkzilla in Japan. And the thing is that her father, you know, after she kind of basically got killed by, almost killed by, you know, space debris in the third movie, her father rebuilt her. So it made sense that he might have built clones. So there's these friends. Right. So they vetoed that. And when we did the sixth movie, we did Planet of the Aprils, which was like, he ends up in the future and we got to do our Tara Reid clones, which is one of my favorite parts of that movie.
Well, you know, but here's the thing. Why are they giving you parameters like that? The beauty of this is really, it's almost, I not literally what I'm about to say, but almost pretty much anything goes that sort of fits within the world that you've created. Why would they say no to the clones? Why is that too outrageous for them in a movie about sharks that come out of the sky because of a tornado? I mean, like, how does that thinking work on their part, do you think?
Well, I think there are so many ideas with these movies. We would end up on the last two films, end up with like 140 page scripts. So we had
Jesus, really?
We it. And then we would come back with 2.5 hours and we'd cut it down to 85 minutes and make it the best of whatever we got. So it wasn't that, this is a great idea. You know, we're going to crap on your idea. Go away, kid. It was more like, no, we don't think it works here. And then, you know, you find something else that's better. I think that the imagination in all the films are, you know, there was never a thing where I ever felt constrained or constricted by it. Mm-hmm. You know, when we're on set, I mean, half the time we're coming up with stuff on the spot. I mean, there's a lot of looseness because of the fact that we have no time and money and we have to kind of make things work with what you have. And then there's just things that come out of just, well, you have this here, why not? There was a thing on Sharknado 4, The Force Awakens, where they hired the Chippendales to show up when we were doing the Vegas scene. And I was just standing there going, well, we got to have them do something. And I go, well, what if we have one of them do sort of a crotch rocket, and then they could put a CGI shark in there bouncing off of them, you know, like when he thrust. And it was just like, you know, I go, it's never going to end up on Sci-Fi. And we shot it. And that was one of the first things in the trailer they put together that they showed and that got people interested in the fourth one.
You just don't know.
Yeah.
Right?
It's just so, you know, I always feel like if you really look at them, we got away with murder with these movies. I mean, if you really, really look at how outrageous that they got and the stuff that we did, it's nuts. I mean, I can't believe that these movies existed.
Yeah.
Because any studio would have shut this down. It's like, so now they commandeer a space shuttle in the last 20 minutes of number 3, go up to space, fight sharks with a lightsaber chainsaw. And in order to enter the atmosphere, he gets into a shark. It burns up. He punches his fist through the top of the shark, and then a parachute comes back. Meanwhile, in another shark, his pregnant wife, who was in a spacesuit, has a baby in a shark, and then she, with her chainsaw arm, chainsaws her way out and gives Finn her baby. I mean, they let us get away with a lot.
You clearly ripped that idea off for somebody else. No,
it was
original.
Rayman. Rayman had that scene in there, and we liberally ripped it off with Tom Cruise.
Exactly. As you're doing the movies, you know, like, okay, I'm a stand-up, and you know, you have good shows, and then you want to have an even better show and a better show. Do you were you feeling the need? Fans really become fans of things like this, right? Do fans start to question any of the logic or the premises or the storylines? And B, are you feeling the pressure with each installment to top yourself or to make sure that your fans are satisfied as you're writing this? Or is it more just what you and Thunder Levin and the, and the brain trust of this like and want? How do you balance all of that?
Well, there's three or four parts to this. So part one was, I think the only time we were ever kind of knocked on something that kind of irritated me and actually turned it into a positive was the first movie. I would get questions from the press or people like, or you'd see online, like, you know, this is impossible. Sharks can't live in a tornado. And I'm like, well, yeah. And cars don't turn to robots. So where's that line? there's a line with the robots, but you know, once you get to Sharks with a Tornado, no, I can't grasp that. I can't understand that concept. And you are wrong. You guys are horrible people for trying that. So when people would say that, I'm like, really? And so one of the answers that came up during the press rounds and stuff on that, I would go, here's the thing. They're not sharks and it's not a tornado. It's a Sharknado and it's our villain. And our villain could do whatever we want it to do. And once I said that, when we got into the second movie, it's like all you know, the gloves are off. It's like, yeah, sharks can take down an airplane. They can go into space. We can do time travel. And that was liberating for us. So that one little nod, you know, there's people that are going to hate watch these movies. And, you know, we don't pay attention to that, those. But in terms of topping it, you know, yeah, every movie, you know, we felt like an obligation to give a ride. I mean, The one of the things that people don't realize about the first Sharknado, or maybe, you know, because they don't watch these movies a lot, these types of films, there's a lot going on for an $800,000 movie.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Sharknado 1 is nonstop. And if you think about, we shot that movie in 18 days and finished it in less than 6 months. A lot of low-budget movies have maybe only one sequence. So a template for these movies are, you have sort of a teaser. At about the 20-minute mark, something cool happens. At the 45-minute mark, maybe something cool happens, and then you sort of fail at an ending. I mean, it's just, and it's not any fault of anybody. It's just that the nature of movies, you know, it just, that's what you do. And I wanted to see how much stuff we could push into the film with our budget, and the network and the production company Asylum just let me, you know, have a lot of rope to hang myself with. So the first Sharknado, it's just wall to wall. It doesn't stop. And it just gets progressively weirder and weirder as it goes along. And so with that, going into the second movie, you're like, okay, well, we have a lot to stop. But I think one of the most important things for me was, there was a lot of rough edges with that first movie. I mean, you know, there's some CGI is a little wonky, and they're, you know, used a little too much stock shots because we had to. And also, we shoot Tornado movie in Los Angeles. And that year, there was literally no rain. It rained the first 2 days of shooting, but we were inside doing, you know, burn and process car shots. And then after that, it was sunny skies. So we had to avoid the skies, or we had to do digital effects. And once we got to the second movie, we were in New York, and we were able to actually point the move, you know, the camera up and see the city and see the skies, because it's always overcast in the winter in New York.
Right.
And so, you know, the goal with the second movie was to sand off those rough edges. And I think the second movie is the best one of all six, because, you know, everything kind of worked perfectly in that movie. But yeah, we're trying to top, you know, him coming out of the shark at the end, and we always talk about that Sharknado moment at the end of all these movies. And they would get more and more ambitious. And one of the things too about the second film is, we shot in New York, and anybody that understands filmmaking knows how difficult it is, especially if you have no money.
Oh God, listen, I shot some shorts, 16mm in New York, and you know, it's a lot. Even when you, with permits, I've done it, and without permits, and it's hard. It is really, really hard. Absolutely.
And so when you watch the movie, though, it's like, we were able to shoot in Times Square. We were able to shoot with, you know, at the Statue of Liberty. And there was a couple things where, like, Mets Stadium, we wanted to do Major League Baseball in there. And everybody said, there's no way Major League Baseball is going to let you shoot at the park. And going, no, it's going to happen. And I remember we were going through the process. We were literally 2 weeks out. And I was like, yeah, it's looking dicey. It's like, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. And the Mets came through and we were able to shoot at Citi Field, which is unheard of. We had one day to do all of that stuff. Our location manager came to me and said, you know, there was a scene where we introduced Mark McGrath's character and it was outside their house. And she goes, look, if I can get you Times Square, would you want to change it? I'm going, yeah, what would the parameters be? Well, here's the deal. You would only be able to have like a crew of seven people and you can't stop traffic, but we could put you right in the heart of it. And you would only have 2 hours to shoot the scene. I'm going, okay. And we did it.
That's great. That's great. You know,
a friend of mine, Robbie Rist, I have a band with him called Quint, and we've done a lot of the music for these movies. And I showed him the first cut of Sharknado, and he says it's a movie that doesn't know it can't do that. And it's become true of this franchise. And so once we did New York, we couldn't just go back and pretend we were in a certain place. So when we did the third movie, we went to Orlando. We actually shot at Universal Orlando, the theme park. They let us do things that I can't imagine Disneyland allowing anybody to do, you know. For the fifth movie, we traveled the globe, you know, and we actually went to most of those places. And I have the theory that with our little bit of money and our little caravan of our crew, you know, we could go and do this. And so we ended up filming in London, Tokyo, Australia, Italy, and Bulgaria. And we were shooting in these actual places. And when we went to Italy, we were looking at Trevi Fountain and going, there's no way you could shoot at Trevi Fountain. I'm going, well, why? Because too many people are there. Like, so they started showing us all these fountains on the location scout. I'm like, all right, it's fine. And they take us to Trevi Fountain and I'm looking at it going, we have to shoot at Trevi Fountain. And like, when is there nobody here? And they go, Sunday at 6 a.m. It's like, well, then we'll shoot Sunday at 6 a.m. It's like, well, it's the same thing. It's 2 hours is always the answer. Well, you know, it's like, well, you're only going to have 2 hours. Like, fine. We shot in New York and in Times Square in 2 hours. We could do a scene at Trevi Fountain. And they're like, no, you can't. It's like, yes, we can.
Yeah.
And so we get there and there's nobody there. We shoot a master shot of a car coming up. We have Ian and Tara in front of Trevi Fountain. And we start shooting wide. We start going into medium. Why would we get the close-ups? People start showing up. And after 2 hours, we're gone. And we did it.
Yeah.
Same thing with London. We shot. We filmed on Tower Bridge. And I see Spider-Man, the Homecoming movie, doing literally the same exact thing that we did with Sharknado. And yet they probably had, for the time that they were there, you know, like, you know, $50 million. And, you know, we had probably 10,000 to do everything that we did.
But you know what? You do get a lot of bang for your buck. When I, you know, was sort of delving into this more and you know, prepping for my conversation with you. Yeah, it wasn't a mega blockbuster budget. You could see that. But I didn't think it was 18 days and under $1 million. The quality of what you've gotten out of your crew and yourself and the effects you use, it's really quite spectacular. And I'm really psyched about Zombie Tidal Wave. I got to tell you that. You can't make enough of these for me. Zombie Tidal Wave is on Sci-Fi, and I assume we'll have a bunch of installments, hopefully, of Zombie Tidal Wave now, because I think we need them. So I hope you make more, and also the music. Well, you know, you're writing the music and doing the music for these things as well, and people should check out the music as well. Is there a place where people can get the music, download the music, anything like that?
Yeah, our band name is Quint. And we have a bunch of EPs on iTunes and Spotify. If you look up Ballad of Sharknado and you'll find all of our stuff, populated with that. We have a new EP called Club Dead coming out, right before the movie comes out, which you know, a lot of the songs for this movie, you know, it's Zombie Tidal Wave, even though it's set in present, it definitely has an 80s vibe. I kind of wanted to kind of embrace the Lucio Fulci-ness of it. And so the songs definitely kind of feel more 80s. We did a sort of kind of ska thing called Club Dead, and sort of a punky thing called Party to Raise the Dead, and you know, and the ultimate punk anthem, Suck It. It's kind of like a musical when we do this. Suck It was just like one of these angry songs. Like, you get so tired, and he's like, okay, we're going to write something just angry. Yeah. And there's a character named Blaine that we put in the movie that's sort of a douchebag. So we kind of wrote it with sort of his, from his POV.
That's great. So, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's great, and I'm really happy for your success, and it's great to meet you, man. It's really interesting to hear. I'm kind of a process geek, and it's really interesting to hear how you've been able to make these movies and sort of stay true to what you guys want to do. And you seem like you guys are really enjoying it yourself. And I think Thunder Levin said, you know, it's about the filmmakers being in on the joke in some way, which allows the audience to be in on the joke, but never winking at it. And I think that's really great. So Zombie Tidal Wave, Sharknado franchise, check them all out. Really great to have you on. And let's do this again when you got something going on.
That's great. Yeah. And they air on Sci-Fi this weekend. Zombie Tidal Wave debuts 9 o'clock Eastern Sci-Fi. And all the Sharknado movies are also airing. So hopefully people enjoy it, and we'll have many, many more to come. One other quick thing, speaking of, you know, movies, you know, doesn't know it can't do that. I was just in Malaysia,
mm-hmm.
and there's a theme park called Sunway Lagoon, and the first Sharknado attraction at a theme park.
Awesome. Are you serious? That's awesome. Look at this. That's when you've arrived, man. You've arrived.
they had a Malaysian Sin and Nova, and then they were actually using our theme song, Ballad of Nato, did like on the beachy area, because it's a water park. They twice a day, they have people running around the beach like Shark Attack, and then doing a synchronized dance sequence to the song. And it's just like the silly song that Robbie and I wrote like 6 years ago became the theme. You know, it's like, I remember someone telling me, don't write that song. You know, your people are going to laugh at you. Like, no, it's fun. And now it's like, we're going to have like these kids for the next 3 years growing up in Malaysia, singing Ballad of Sharknado, going, go, 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 go.
That's awesome.
It's a trip.
And then like in 30 years from now, some young filmmaker is going to want to, like you at the Trevi Fountain, is going to want to film at your amusement park ride. And they're going to say, you can't film in front of the Sharknado ride. It's busy all the time. And they're going to say, when is it not busy? 6 a.m. on a Sunday. And they're going to say, all right, that's great, man. Well, it's well-deserved, and it's really refreshing. All these movies are refreshing in this sort of mega blockbuster era that we live in, and nothing against those movies. So and it's a great story, and how passionate you guys are about it. So it's all the way things should be in terms of making art and all of that. So congratulations, and check out Zombie Tidal Wave on Sci-Fi this week. And also the Sharknado movies are out there to catch. If you haven't watched them, then there's something wrong with you, and go watch them immediately. So Anthony Ferrante, it's great to have you on, man.
Thanks again. Hopefully we can do this again. I really appreciate it.
All right, there you go. Anthony Ferrante. Very cool guy. You could hear how passionate he is about it. And, you know, it's a nice contrast to the mega blockbuster movies that you see every summer. So check out the movies, Sharknado and the Zombie Tidal Wave. Just, you got to love the title right there. And please follow me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, at Paul Mercurio, and spread the word. Send some links around about podcasts. Tell your family, tell your friends, and leave some nice comments on iTunes if you don't mind. Thanks, everybody.